What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today we are talking about setting up the perfect fat loss phase. What does that look like? We're going to talk about so-called non-negotiables that you should have in place before starting a fat loss phase. And then we're going to talk about some of those nuts and bolts of setting certain targets, calories and protein, fiber, you know, how to manage social events, how long you should diet, how do you transition back to maintenance. And as I was making a couple notes for this, I was like, man, this could be a really long podcast. But what's funny is some of this stuff is where people get really hung up, and I think unnecessarily hung up. And other parts of this are where people kind of glaze over it. And those are certain things. Like I was reading, I was like, each one of these topics could be its own podcast. And I was like, actually, that's not true. Some of this stuff is, you know, where people spend a lot of time and they shouldn't. And other parts of this are where people don't spend a lot of time and should. And so I might point that out, but you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I can't, you know, they're going to look and try and fast forward to the setting calories and protein part. Or setting macros or all that stuff, how big of a deficit. And it's just funny, like that isn't ultimately like by any stretch the most important thing or one of, you know, that, you know, doing that correctly, in my opinion, is not a great predictor of one's ability to lose fat and keep it off, but it's where people spend a lot of time. So without further ado, a couple of things before we jump into some pre-fat loss checklist stuff. If this is all highly individualized, fat loss pursuits are different for different people. People have different lifestyles, different genetics, different preferences, different past experiences, different starting body compositions. Did I say different genetics? They have different limiting beliefs, education. And so there's so many differences between us. There, of course, we all, you know, are have to live within the law of thermodynamics, and we all have to, be in a calorie deficit, and protein's important. And there are a lot of things that are important to, you know, all of us. A lot of overlapping just truths, but the process of losing weight and keeping it off is going to be a little bit different for everybody. And so this is going to be a little bit of a general run through of each of those buckets, or, you know, maybe, you know, hopefully giving you some things to think about when we talk about some of these things, rather than like an exact, very specific blueprint of eat this many calories, because like I said, people are different, coming from different places, have done different things, have different beliefs and lifestyles and preferences and experiences and all of that. So we are going to begin with certain non-negotiables that I would want you to work on before or have in place before starting a fat loss phase. And now ideally, I'd like to have all of these in check before we go into a calorie deficit. Now, I'm going to list a bunch of things, you know, I don't know, 5 to 10 things that I think you should have in place before attempting to lose weight. And there's going to be somebody out there who either says hypothetically or anecdotally that they've done this, meaning that they've worked on these things while they were losing weight and that they did those two things simultaneously. I'm saying in a chronological order, I would want you to work on this stuff before you try and lose weight. And I'll explain why. But there's people out there that say, hey, Jordan, like, is technically speaking, you could do both of these at the same time. And I think that that's true, technically speaking. In practice, after working with hundreds, probably thousands of people at this point, you know, intimately in a one-on-one setting of fat loss, you know, trying to lose weight and maintain it, you know, the biggest predictor of whether or not you'll actually lose weight and whether or not, more importantly, you'll be able to keep it off is what your life looked like going into it. Now, yeah, that's tough to say because I think people have made a lot of changes during the course of fat loss as well. But spending some time on the front end sharpening your axe is going to, you know, in that analogy, help you ultimately cut down that tree later. And so there's, even if you spend several months to a year improving some of these lifestyle habits, it will make all future fat loss pursuits easier because you have all of these foundational habits. At the end of the day, you have all of the things in check that will make sustaining a deficit easier and will make sustaining your fat loss results more likely. And so the more I do this, the more I, like, philosophically speaking, I have to agree that technically it's true. You could focus on these lifestyle changes and be in a deficit. You could, totally. But I'm betting on the person who spends, you know, 2 to 6 months, 2 to 12 months, whatever, however long it takes to get this stuff in check before trying to reduce calories and deal with all of the stuff that can happen from there physiologically and psychologically. You know, I have a saying in my coaching, how's it going to be different this time if it's not different this time? People hire me because they've tried a million different things. You know, I'm nobody's first attempt at fat loss, you know, or maybe, but for the most part, people are coming to me after many or multiple attempts to lose weight. And my question to them is, how's it going to be different this time if it's not different this time? And one of the ways that it's going to be different this time is we're going to spend some time on the front end on this stuff. So I'll stop waffling. We're already 5 minutes into the podcast. Haven't said a darn thing. And so the first one is lifting weights 2 to 4 weeks. And these aren't necessarily in any particular order. These are just, this is how my brain kind of vomited them out. The first one is 2 to 4 times per week lifting weights. And the funny thing is, this doesn't even have much to do with fat loss. Lifting weights is not a big contributor to your overall energy expenditure. It doesn't burn a lot of calories. Even building more muscle, a lot of people want to say, oh, build more muscle, boost your metabolism. It doesn't really. I mean, it does technically, but not by a whole lot. You know, a pound of fat burns like 3 calories per day, 3 to 5 calories a day. Pounds of muscle is like 5 to 10 calories per day. You'd have to build an F ton of muscle for that to really meaningfully impact metabolism. So why am I so high on weightlifting? The truth is, from a health perspective, if you go into a deficit and you are not lifting any weights whatsoever, you're going to lose a large percentage of that weight from lean mass, and that's not going to be good for your health. Now, there are contexts where the loss of body weight and lean mass is a net win, for sure. And there's, we can get into the weeds with like, okay, but how much muscle and at what point, after what threshold is it no longer a net win for health? But if you're going to be in a deficit and you want to lose weight, we want to lose fat, not weight. We want to lose fat. And when I say not weight, what I mean is if you're just like, oh, I want to lose weight. It's like, yeah, weight is water weight. It's fat. It's muscle. From a health perspective, the thing you want to lose is fat, not muscle. Yeah, I mean, water is mostly benign in this context. So we need to be lifting weights because if you go into a deficit, we're going to lose a significant amount of lean body mass. You might lose some lean body mass anyway, even if you're lifting, but you will, to a large part, mitigate that. Some people will even gain muscle in a deficit if you're newer to training, and a lot of people will roughly maintain. I wouldn't fearmonger much about muscle loss if you're lifting weights 2 to 4 times a week, hard, you know, going to the gym and working hard. I wouldn't worry too much about muscle loss, but I would worry about it enough that I'm suggesting it at the very top of this podcast. The next one is getting at least 8,000 steps per day. Now, this is fairly arbitrary. It's true. This whole 10,000 steps craze is arbitrary. It was invented by like a Japanese like pedometer company that wanted to help encourage people to, you know, they wanted to sell more pedometers. They got this whole 10,000 steps going on. They're like, oh, 10,000 steps is, you know, you need to get our pedometer so you burn 10,000. It was essentially a marketing ploy. But since then, there's been some decent research and a couple of things. So, I'm going to misquote the paper, but there seems to be from an appetite suppressant effect. So what we do know is that if you're sedentary and you go from sedentary to active, we see that your hunger signals will line up more appropriately with your energy expenditure. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. A lot of people are hungrier, more hungry than they burn calories. What we want is those two things kind of in line with each other. And in a deficit, obviously, we want to burn more calories. And so what we see is appetite regulation going from sedentary to active or moderately active, let's say. What we don't see is that people who are moderately active or active who exercise even more get a continued benefit in terms of appetite regulation. So there seems to be, you know, a diminishing return and probably an upside down U-shaped curve where you get really, really active and you actually get way, 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 way more hungry. And personally, I've experienced that as I do a lot more cardio work these days. So we see somewhere around that 8,000 steps per day range, we get the benefit somewhere between 8 and 12,000 steps, the benefit of this appetite regulating effect. And of course, being more active on average burns calories. The truth is, if you get 5,000 steps per day, 4,000 steps per day, the amount of calories that you'll have to eat is just going to be notably lower. And it's already challenging to lose weight and keep it off. People say stuff like, you know, it's really difficult to outwork a bad diet, right? That's something that you'll hear. I think it's just as, I mean, whether or not it's just as hard or harder, I find it myself saying this more, that it's actually harder to out-diet your sedentary lifestyle. And so I think that getting at least 8,000 steps per day is a non-negotiable because the calories will just be have to be even lower than they're already going to have to be. And you're going to have to be even hungrier than you're already going to have to be. And so I think that this is one of the more powerful non-negotiables. I think is just, I've just had clients be like, you know what? I can't get more steps. I'm getting 4,000. Can I just lower calories? Yes, you can. Physiologically speaking, you can. I'm just not betting on that leading to a really sustainable long-term positive outcome. Anything else on that? Those are steps that you can get on average. So over the course of 7 days on a running average is what I would shoot for. You might get 10,000 on some days, 6,000 on other days. We're looking for somewhere around that 8 to 12,000 range on average over the course of the week. And, you know, nowhere in this discussion will I talk about specific higher intensity cardio. That is something I chose to omit just because I don't think that using higher intensity cardio as a tool to lose fat is a really great strategy. I do think that walking is. It seems to have a less profound effect on hunger. Higher intensity cardio on average seems to have a higher impact on hunger. And so if we can keep hunger down, and that's probably a good thing. So I would recommend mostly lower intensity stuff for now if your goal is fat loss. Of course, if you simultaneously wanted to do some higher intensity stuff for the heart health benefits, that's cool. But, you know, maybe you don't have to do everything all at once, you know, kind of having all those knobs turned all the way to the top there, all the way to 11. Cool. Next. Wow, this is going to be a long podcast. We are on number three of these non-negotiables. All righty. I'll try and move through these a little quicker. Next is some form of meal building philosophy. And I am big on two of them. One of them is called protein and a plant, which just is a really easy thing to remember in terms of building meals. Start building your meals around a protein and a plant. If you follow me for any amount of time, you know that that's like comes out of my mouth every 5 seconds. When you're thinking of building a meal, think, what protein am I going to have? What plant am I going to have? That could be a fruit or a vegetable. What goes well with that protein? And then fill your plate with whatever else you want, right? Pick a protein, get a hearty portion of plants, and then, you know, fill the rest of your plate. And the next quote or saying, it's funny, is I just did a podcast recently about my favorite and least favorite fitness sayings. This is obviously one of my favorite ones, is have what you want and add what you need. And it's kind of the opposite of the protein in a plant. So protein in a plant means start with a protein in a plant, start thinking about what protein in a plant you want, and then you can think about what goes well with that, right? So pick your protein, piece of salmon. Pick your plant, spinach. And you're like, okay, what is another component that I would want to eat with that? You're like, potatoes, great. Have what you want, add what you need is almost doing that in the inverse, where you're like, I really want these air-fried potatoes that we make, or I really want a bowl of pasta or something. It's like, okay, have what you want, but add what you need. You're like, I want pasta. It's like, okay, we're having pasta. We're starting with the thing you want, but then we are rounding out the meal with what you need. And so I really think that those are important philosophies to get in place. They will bode well. They will help you. They will serve you well beyond tracking. At the end of the day, improvements in nutrition quality from more fiber, more micronutrients, more protein, more, you know, just nutrient dense satiating foods is going to help you whether or not you ultimately try and lose fat or not. And also some reframing of portion sizes. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, protein in a plant. And then they have 2 eggs and 10 blueberries. And they're like, cool, that's my protein in a plant. And then I'm going to have, you know, half a loaf of bread. It's like, well, we need to reframe some of these portion sizes. 2 eggs, not enough protein. 10 blueberries, that's not a portion. You know, so sometimes reframing what a portion of plants and a portion of protein looks like, also very important. Next is a meal timing and meal frequency you can stick to most of the time. What I mean is, you know, it's 3 o'clock right now. If you just walk into my office and you say, Jordan, when are you eating tomorrow? And what are you eating? I might not be able to tell you exactly every single component of every meal I'm going to eat tomorrow, but I could tell you a rough outline of what's going to happen. That's because I have a rough outline of when I eat on most days, right? I eat my first meal somewhere between, 8 and 9:30, 8:30, 9:30. I eat my second meal around noon, my third meal between 2 and 4, my last meal between 5 and 7. And I eat 4 times a day. Sometimes, you know, some meals are bigger than others. Depending on when I train, sometimes, you know, I'm having certain things. I know that my daily protein sources are, like, I have 4 meals per day, and they happen at roughly those times. And my 4 protein sources are a Greek yogurt or cottage cheese, eggs, sliced deli turkey right now, or a protein shake, and then dinner, which tends to be kind of more of a rotating option. And so I can tell you right now, those are my protein options. I'm having a yogurt meal, I'm having a protein shake meal. I'm having an egg meal. And then I'm having that rotating dinner. It could be a steak, could be a salmon, could be a chicken, could be whatever. You need to have some sort of structure, some sort of pattern. It doesn't need to be the exact same food at the exact same time every single day until you drop dead. But you gotta have some pattern, some structure. You cannot open your fridge every day and just randomly wait in the morning until you feel hungry, and then you open your fridge and your pantry and you're like, what should I eat? And you're just making it up from scratch every day. I love the analogy of if you had to change your clothes, your whole outfit, shirt, pants, socks, watch, you know, accessories, every day, three times a day, right? If you had to change your whole outfit three times a day, I guarantee you within a week of doing that, you would buy 20 of the same shirts, 20 of the same pants, 20 of the same socks. You'd be tired. You'd be exhausted. And you say, you know what? I'm going to put some of this shit on repeat. And that's what we need to do. Some sort of meal timing, frequency, pattern, structure that you can stick to most of the time. Next is some form of meal prep. That does not mean you need to be the bodybuilder who makes 48,000 chicken breasts and individually portions out his chicken, rice, broccoli meal into 87 Tupperwares on the kitchen counter. That's not what I'm talking about. You could do that. You could do that, but some form of meal prep. So that's everything from actual like traditional meal prep to stocking your house with low or no cook options, right? There's a lot of like things from Costco. Those I'm thinking things that come to mind are like things like Kevin's or those sous vide options. There's a company that makes amazing sous vide proteins, or buying from a meal prep company, right? So there are a lot of ways to do some form of meal prep. I just think, even for me, I live at home, I work from home. If I have to cook up a fresh meal with like a bunch of raw ingredients four times a day, I ain't doing it, right? You heard what my meals are. It's an egg meal that takes cooking, but it's super low technique, right? There's no like, I'm not stressing about, you know, eight different components. I scramble up some friggin' eggs in the thing and I toast some stuff and I get some berries and I'm done. The second meal is a yogurt bowl with frozen fruit, super easy. Third one is a protein shake, friggin' throw it in the blender. Dinner is the only meal where I like put any modicum of effort into. And so again, some form of meal prep where you're kind of lowering the bar of how much work it takes to get a nutritious meal. Next is a commitment to work on your relationship with food and body and have some goals outside of fat loss. Truthfully, a lot of people think that weight loss is going to make them happier, that being smaller is going to make them happier. And I am not saying that weight loss doesn't or can't have some quality of life enhancements. It absolutely can. Of course it can. But I don't think being a little leaner is going to make your life do a 180. So make sure that either if you're doing this by yourself or you're working with a coach, that you have some sort of maybe performance goal. You want to get your first chin up, or you're talking and being introspective and being aware of the whole like what my body can do versus how small I am, that you have other hobbies. Maybe you're picking up a sport or you want to go on a challenging hike, you know, or you really want to focus on setting a good example for your kids. Like, we need to round out your priorities and values when it comes to nutrition and health and fitness. It can't just be about aesthetics. It can also be about aesthetics, but it can't just be about aesthetics. Next is be in your bed for 8 hours. We call this a sleep opportunity. You know, you can't always control your sleep quality, but what you can control is my light goes out at this time and I try and start sleeping at this time and my alarm goes off at this time and I get out of bed at this time. So you can't always control exactly how well you sleep, but you can say, I'm getting the hell off my phone at 8:30. I'm going to read a book at 9 and I'm lights out at 10. My alarm's at 6. You know, you can do everything. What I mean is it doesn't need to be that exact routine. I don't mean to pretend like I know what everyone's life is like. I have a newborn. Trust me, it's not like that for me right now. I'm just saying, for the most part, fat loss is hard enough. Doing fat loss while you're on 5 hours a night sleep, 3 hours a night sleep, then 8 hours a night sleep, then 6 hours a night sleep, and it's kind of all over the place, is going to be really, really challenging. So trying to be in your bed for 8 hours gives you the a sleep opportunity that is large enough that I bet people feel pretty good on average, right? We know it's not rocket science. When you are sleep deprived, we see an increase in ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone, you know, and that brings with it a whole other pool of kind of symptoms and behaviors that, you know, like people feel like they have less willpower. They have more cravings. They're hungrier. They're more tired. They're less likely to want to go for a workout. So sleep is mega important. And then last is, again, some emphasis on health. And that's a little bit distinctive of what a distinctive from what I said before. And this is more about maybe getting some blood work done, where like we have some markers that you can't see on the scale or in the mirror that we can get really excited about. You might be like, you know, I lost 5-10 pounds and I don't feel like I look that different. And you might be down on your progress, but you've been lifting weights this whole time and you can do your first chin up and your LDL cholesterol is down and your blood pressure is down. And because you know that, it's going to make things infinitely more sustainable. I mean, that's really what freaking matters, right? I mean, I'm not saying aesthetics don't matter, but we should get just as excited, if not way more so, about a reduction in blood pressure than, you know, we do compared to like, yo, I saw my first, you know, arm muscle in the mirror, you know, which is awesome too, by the way. I'm not poo-pooing that. That's awesome. It's friggin' awesome. I love that stuff. But like, being able to also have non-aesthetic objective markers of health that we can assess and see improve is awesome. And I would say a non-negotiable, you know, either go get blood work when you start working with your coach or, you know, periodically have blood work on hand from, you know, prior to starting this that you can refer back to and say, hey, I really would love to see this, this, and this improve, right? So, you know, you might be thinking, oh, I'm going to miss my walk today, or I'm not motivated to get my workout in. And if you can think about that too, being like, you know what, this is really good for my blood pressure. It's really good for my LDL cholesterol. It's really good for my, you know, C-reactive protein. It's good for my inflammatory markers. Like it just can give you a more holistic, like, army of motivators that aren't just, I want to be smaller. Cool. Quick sip of water. And then we are going to move into some of the nuts and bolts of setting fat loss phases, what that looks like. So once you've done those, we can talk about things like setting targets. Should you include yummy foods? How long should you diet? How to transition out of dieting? How to handle social events and stuff like that. So let's start with setting your calories or calories and protein versus macros. This is like a common argument I see. Should you track all three macros or just calories and protein? I have an entire podcast on that topic, I think, that I will link in the description. But the long and short of it is if you equate calories and protein, your distribution of carbs and fats will have no impact on your results whatsoever. Like, I'm saying that in an absolute sense. If I were being fair, I would probably pull back on the absolute language like 1%, but I'd say it 99.999% the same results. Meaning if you have a little more fat or a little bit more carb, it won't matter if you eat the same calories and the same protein. And so what I recommend is don't track all three macros. Track calories, track protein. Track calories, track protein, right? You're going to get the same results with more flexibility. Right. I think of clients back in the day who were tracked all three macros and they like went out to a steakhouse and they didn't have any more fat macros. So they got like chicken breast and asparagus at the steakhouse. I'm like, dude, you know, you could have had the same calories. All right. You got chicken breast, asparagus and a baked potato, let's say. And they really wanted to have a steak and they could have had the steak within their calories, but they didn't have the fat macros for it. And it's like, dude. Have the steak, hit your calories, hit your protein, and you're good. The ability to have, like, when people think about tracking, they think it's like this big, crazy, neurotic eating disorder where you have shackles on. It's like, dude, if we can make this more flexible, we should. First of all, tracking's not like that. It becomes even less like that if you use things like tracking calories and protein instead of all three macros. I'm not going to go into that too deep. I'll link a description to a podcast where I go in a little bit more depth, but the truth is, I don't think I have any clients right now with all three macro targets. Yeah, and that should say something, I guess. So when it comes to setting calories for fat loss, remember, there's, you know, we can assume that you already know your maintenance calories, or we can assume that you don't. Let's assume that you don't. Here's the deal. Use any calorie calculator out there, anything. I don't care if it's Harris Benedict or it's the, you know, I'm so far out of that game with like these, which calorie calculator should I use? Freaking any of them. I don't care if you go Jordan Syatt style and you just go body weight times 12. You know, I don't care. None of them are going to be perfect. They're all going to be educated guesses. Just use any calorie calculator to calculate your maintenance calories, period. Anything, just anything. It's all going to be a starting point. When it comes to the size of the deficit, here's what I care about most. I care that it, so when I think of what is the range of calories I would want somebody to cut from their maintenance calories, here's where I draw those upper and lower end thresholds. The deficit needs to be large enough to yield results that are tangible and meaningful such that you can derive motivation from that. And this is pretty clear in the research. When we see people who are on very low calorie dieting versus people that are on like very small deficits, so very large deficit versus very small, people in very large deficits end up actually having better adherence because they're losing weight and they're more excited about it. They can see the number moving on the scale. They know that it's working. Yes, they are more hungry, but to them, they're getting such a robust result that they can kind of manufacture motivation from that. Whereas like if you're losing 0.3 pounds on the scale, you're probably in a very small deficit, which means you're probably not that uncomfortable, but there's a psychological cost to trying to lose weight. And if you're trying to lose weight, you might as well actually lose weight. And so I want to make sure you're in at least a large enough deficit where you lose an amount of weight that you can actually tangibly see on the scale and isn't washed away by daily fluctuations. You need to lose enough weight. Again, doesn't need to be every week, but on average over time, where you can actually pull some motivation from that. And so I usually say it's got to be at least 300 calories below maintenance. If you're in a 200 calorie deficit, that's like, technically speaking, you lose about 0.4 pounds of fat per week, but 0.4 pounds on the scale, your body weight's going to fluctuate more than that on a day-to-day basis. You know, it might be weeks before you see weight loss. And yes, I'm not saying crash diet, but I'm also saying the extreme opposite where you're in a micro deficit might not be the best plan either if you have an appreciable amount of fat to lose. If you have a little bit of fat to lose and you're in no rush and you don't even mind if it doesn't happen for several weeks, cool. Play it safe, be more conservative, no problem. If you have an appreciable amount of fat to lose, you're excited, you want to see some change, going with a micro deficit where it might take a month or two before anything changes on the scale, I think is going to be tough to do. I think psychologically it's difficult to be in a state of mind where you're really trying to lose fat without getting any of that positive feedback that it's working. So yeah, again, this is one of those where it really comes down to the individual. And I wrote that like 30 times in this underneath these notes on setting calories. And then the largest, so the upper end threshold of deficit size would be the largest thing you can sustain. So you need a deficit size that's large enough for you to motivate you, but not so large that you're starving, miserable, can't stick to it, workouts suck, you know, and then you just say F it, right? So we need something between large enough that you can see it actually manifest on the scale and get excited about it, but not so large that you're so freaking miserable, barely eating, just like sucking on celery sticks and that's it. So that's usually somewhere between 300 and 1,000 calories below maintenance. Somewhere between that. And frankly, there's some pretty cool, interesting research by some smart people on aggressive dieting. I'm going to have a podcast on that. I think that this isn't the time to talk about more aggressive dieting because I think more aggressive dieting physiologically actually might make a lot of sense. But psychologically, based on where most people's relationship with food is a terrible idea. And I even think the people who are proponents of this sort of aggressive dieting approach, one of them is a mentor and the owner of MNU, Martin McDonald, he would agree. I mean, he would say so much himself that your relationship with food needs to be in a really good place for you to do this. So physiologically, there's some cool stuff there, but practically speaking, for the average person on the other end of this podcast, I would not go much lower than 1,000 calories below maintenance. And again, that 1,000 calories, again, is if you're only eating 1,500, 1,600, 1,700, 1,800 calories, is of course not for you, in my opinion. Of course, I don't like using percentages so much, but it, you know, on some level that I see where that can have some merit, because if you have somebody that's eating, you know, 1,700 calories, I think even if they want to diet more aggressively, I don't think I'd put them 1,000 calories lower than that. Of course not. So, percent deficits can be a little tricky though, because people be like, oh, a 20% deficit for someone who's eating like 1,700 calories might, you know, it's 340 calorie deficit. I think that's fine, but I don't know. I don't really love the percents. I feel like it doesn't, feel like it feels a little bit too much like a generalization, but that is kind of what we're doing here. So somewhere between 20 and 33%, 35%, 35% is a huge deficit, but you know, somewhere between 20 and 35% also works. I also recommend using a range. Do not say I'm, you know, people will ask in my Q&As, they're like, I'm eating, my coach gave me 1,360 calories. What in the f are you talking about? What are you talking, 1,360? The precision with which people talk about their calories is always triggering for me just because of how much variation there is in our tracking accuracies and food labels. And it's like, dude, 13, if that's what you are so micro zoomed in the weeds, use a freaking range. Use a 200 calorie range. Say I'm eating between 1,800 and 2,000 calories on average across the week. Widen up the goalposts, you will stack more wins. Widen up the bullseye, you will hit it more often. And so, you know, there is no difference in your results if you hit 1960 or if you said, hey, from 19 to 2000, somewhere in there. It's going to have the exact same results, but one of them is going to allow you to feel, like if you say I'm eating 1960 and you eat 1910, you might feel like a failure. Or you eat 1990, you might feel like a failure. When in reality, those are both within a deviation that is not going to impact your results whatsoever. So use a range, right? And calculate on average, right? Calculate on, you can have a day where you eat 2,100 and a day where you eat 1,700, right? I don't recommend most people start out with intentional calorie cycling, but it can work. Calorie cycling is just where you eat a little bit more on some days, and a little bit more on other days. It can absolutely work, but for kind of first-time trackers, I would love to see a little bit more stability to your intake on a day-to-day basis. I feel like sometimes the whole weekend warrior mentality can come out where you're like, well, can I just do two high days on the weekend and then starve myself all week? It's like, well, technically, yeah, but practically not the best plan. So calorie cycling can absolutely work. If you search calorie cycling on my website on the podcast tab, you'll see I've done a bunch of podcasts and Q&As on calorie cycling. You can learn about it more there. When it comes to setting protein intake, I'm, as of this recording, saying I like to see at least 0.7 grams per pound. And you do that because we want to eat enough protein to support muscle mass and stay satiated. Whole food protein sources are some of the most satiating foods you can eat. Technically not the most satiating. Technically things like a boiled potato and an orange are the most satiating. But yeah, things like chicken breast, you know, salmon, lean red meats, turkey breast, really, you know, egg whites, incredibly, incredibly satiating per calorie. So I like 0.7 grams per pound for maintaining muscle and staying satiated. But I got to tell you, I'm not so fussed if it's a little bit lower than that, if you feel good. Like if you tell me, yeah, Jordan, I'm way happier and I feel way better and I can adhere to my calories way better when I eat 0.5 grams per pound and I'm lifting weights three times a week, do I really need to sweat that extra 0.2 grams per pound? I do not think you do. I'm telling you, training hard is, the training stimulus is orders of magnitude more powerful than protein when it comes to actually stimulating the retention of muscle in a deficit. I'm not really stressing that 0.2. Yeah. I think 0.7 grams per pound is where we start to see a drop off. It's like a near maximal benefit in terms of building muscle and certainly going to be nice and satiated. But if you told me straight up, I don't like eating that much protein and I feel plenty satiated and I feel more enjoyable and it's more sustainable with less protein, you're not going to hear a fight out of me. Next, I like actually setting fiber targets. So lately I've been having clients track calories, protein, and fiber. And the current best recommendation is about 10 to 15 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories. So if you're eating 1,500 calories, that's anywhere from 15 grams to 22.5 grams. That math just fried me. My brain shot around 3 o'clock. I don't know why I recorded this right now, but we're running on fumes here. So at 15 to 22 grams, you know, another recommendation is women anywhere from 20 to 25 and men over 30. I think that's fine too. The truth is the more the merrier. The more fiber you eat, the healthier you will be linearly until you get GI discomfort. So fiber is very much the more the merrier. Don't let the carnivore crowd tell you it's not essential. That is true. It's not essential, meaning you would survive without fiber, but you will do much better with it. So 10 to 15 grams per 1,000 calories. I think, you know, for women, we can say let's get above 20. For men, let's get above 30. Again, it's mostly down to body size. I don't mean to generalize the sexes there, but, you know, let's just back of the envelope say that men are on average larger. And not only that, but diversity is important. So there's a lot of companies that, you know, that are making foods that have a lot of, they've been enriched with fiber, even things like Olipop, or people who, you know, are taking fiber gummies or Metamucil, or people taking psyllium husk, or these Mission Carb wraps, or, you know, other foods that have, you know, a ton of fiber in them. And that's not bad, by the way. Quantity of fiber is important, but diversity of fiber is so important as well. It's hard to say that one is more important than the other, but I guess, you know, I'd rather you get 20 grams of fiber because, you know, you had dark leafy greens and, you know, blueberries and an avocado and some whole grains and some beans. Then you say, I got 30 grams of fiber because I had 5 mission wraps. It's like, well, you traded away some of the diversity for the quantity. And I think that in that extreme example, that's a poor trade. Cool. Now, this discussion of should you include yummy stuff? So I'll say this. What I mean is that, like, some, you know, when you decrease the calories you're eating, what we need to do is we need to increase the satiety per calorie of your diet so that you can feel, you know, as little hunger as possible. But some hunger is 100% normal and is going to happen. But you want to at least stack the deck in your favor. And the thing that you want to do is you want to eat foods that have a greater satiety per calorie that make you more full for the amount of calories that they cost, let's say. What that means is probably eating less, like, yummy junk food, right? A little less chips, candy, cakes, you know, a little less pasta, you know, a little less, you know, just kind of cookies and snacky foods, pretzels, whatever. And a little bit more, you know, lean proteins, fruits, vegetables, dark leafy greens, legumes, whole grains, a little bit more of that stuff. The problem is how much along this continuum should you shift? Should you shift all the way to the point where you never, ever, ever, ever eat anything remotely kind of yummy that doesn't score well on satiety per calorie? Or do you have some of it? And if you have some of it, where do you draw the line? And I think this is highly individual. And so this is why I put this in there is I wrote, include enough yummy stuff that you don't feel over-restricted, but not so many that it displaces more satiating stuff and you're always hungry. And I think that might take some guess and check, right? Everybody's different. You might say, and I will say this, and I know a lot of people will nod along with me, that because they were able to fit in a piece of chocolate daily, it really kept them sane, and it was an important part of their calorie deficit, their fat loss experience. I 100% sympathize with that feeling. There are other people that were like, you know what? This food, I just, you know, having a tiny bit of it doesn't do it for me. I don't moderate it well, and at least for now, I'm going to not eat it, and that's fine. Now, we'll call that, like, abstinence. I think a lot of people get really triggered when people talk about avoiding certain foods and fat loss. I think people think that they kind of glorify the inclusion of a lot of yummy food. It's almost like this contest to see how much yummy food you can stuff into your, like, nutritious diet and still lose weight. I'll tell you how I feel, and maybe this gives you a different side of the spectrum. My favorite food to eat is pasta. If I'm trying to lose weight, I don't eat any pasta. I eat none, zero pasta. Because to me, the amount of pasta I need to eat to really, really get the full enjoyment is way too many calories. And, like, to me, it's got to be like at least 600 calories of pasta for me to enjoy it. I don't eat pasta. I will trade those carbs away for potatoes. If I could eat, dude, I could eat 300 calories of roasted potatoes and be full. I could eat 800 calories of pasta and not be full. And so for me, that is a trade-off I feel very good about. I'm not going to have pasta while I'm trying to lose weight. And that's okay. And of course, my relationship with food is pretty darn good. I know that I'm not never going to have pasta ever again. So I'm okay with some abstinence. Now, I might feel differently about bread. I might feel differently about other foods. And so it comes down to the individual. It also comes down to certain foods. And it might take a little bit of tinkering, of recalibrating where you are on that continuum. You know, how much yummy stuff keeps you sane without displacing so many calories on not satiating stuff that you're hungry all the time. So I just want to say that that's, for a lot of people, probably not going to be complete abstinence across the board. But I also don't want to poo-poo the idea of abstinence. You know, even, you know, people hear the word abstinence, they think of things like sex or drinking. Like, Like, but even with drinking, you might even say, you know what? When I'm at maintenance and stuff, I don't mind a drink here and there. But like when I am trying to lose weight, I know that those are kind of empty calories from a satiety perspective. And I'm just going to it can be easier mentally to be a little black and white. Again, I'm not saying you should do that. I don't like the glorification of including all this yummy stuff for some people who might do a little bit better with that, a little bit of abstinence. You know, there's going to be for every person who's like, I don't drink during my fat loss phase because that really helps me feel my best, which by the way, it probably will help you feel your best all the time. And there's going to be somebody else who says, you know what? I have a beer on, you know, when I watch the game on Sundays or something, and it really keeps me sane. And it's really, I don't mind training away those calories on that day. And I think both ways are fine. There's nothing inherently right there. We got three more things to talk about. The next is how to handle social events. This can be an entire podcast. I'm going to share what I feel is most powerful to me lately is that I think most people, when they go to social events, and I'm going to say social events as kind of an all-encompassing proxy for moments where tracking is really challenging because you didn't cook the food in the comfort of your own home. So that could be going out to eat in a restaurant, could be maybe ordering takeout, that could be going to a friend's house, that could be, you know, backyard barbecue, whatever. It's all of those moments where tracking your food is really tough, where you're making real rough estimates. Now, I say really tough. It's not impossible to track your food and to get to a decent ballpark. You know, I think I could go to a restaurant and then eat my food and do a rough calculation of calories and protein. I think I could do a decent job. But this might be controversial, but I actually don't think most people should track their calories in those scenarios. I think when the irony is, and I'm going to go on my soapbox about this, but most people quit tracking because of those moments. They're like, it was such a hassle when I was out, or it was such a hassle when mom would come over and bring me food. It was such a hassle when I was at, you know, after that restaurant. What if when you have those moments, you give yourself permission to not track, and instead you focus on more principle-based eating. You focus on some of those meal-building strategies. And you say, you know what, I'm going to this restaurant. I don't know exactly what my calories are going to be. But what I do know is that if I can find myself a nice protein, some vegetables, starch maybe, and I don't drink, and I have a couple club sodas or something, that's going to be really good practice for me when I get out into the real world and I stop tracking one day, perhaps. You need to be able to survive without tracking. And I really feel like these moments are really good opportunities to practice that. So that is my current stance. Not for everybody, but in many cases, things I like practicing with clients when it comes to social events is actually in those moments, not tracking your calories and doubling down on more principle-based eating. The next is we're going to talk about how long you should deficit, and we'll talk about how to transition to maintenance. So how long should you deficit? And the truth is you should deficit for as long as the juice is worth the squeeze. You should deficit for as long as the juice is worth the squeeze. We have no evidence whatsoever, zero, zilch, nada, that taking breaks provides a metabolic advantage. We have zero, zilch, nada evidence that taking breaks makes future dieting easier, that makes future dieting allows you to eat more calories in future diets or helps you break through plateaus in future diets. We have no evidence that that's the case. Taking breaks is a psychological break, right? Going to maintenance, you know, taking a diet break or taking a maintenance phase, they are appeals to psychology. They are practical things you do because if you think about it, like if you have a really large task, and you might do better if you break it up into chunks right when you start. If you're like, hey, I got to have this task done in 2 weeks and I'm going to work on it 5 hours a day and I'm going to take the weekends off, right? And you kind of have broken it up into chunks. You'll do better because you've been able to kind of compartmentalize your efforts into chunks. In this case, you know, it works the same way. You might do better if you take breaks. Maybe, by the way, you might do better just because you might be able to put forth more effort knowing that there are checkpoints along the way where you can maybe eat more and feel a little bit better. But there is no scientific evidence, there's no physiological rationale for why diet breaking would make future dieting easier from a metabolism perspective, and we have a ton of evidence at this point there is none. There is no metabolic hack here. But I think on average, my clients do take breaks. They take breaks when they go away for a long weekend. They take breaks when they go away on vacation. They might take 3 days off and eat more food just because they're not feeling great. So I don't think a lot of people build out, I'm thinking like a lot of people build out these like nutrition periodization. You got to diet for 6 months and then maintenance for 4 months and then diet for 6 months and then maintenance for 3 months and then maintenance for 12 months and then diet again for this many months. And they build out this whole structure and it's like, you just made it up. You just made it up. And I'm not saying having some structure is a bad thing. I'm a structure kind of guy, but you shouldn't build a structure and think that you need that structure or you're going to fail. You don't. You use the structure if it behooves you, if it's benefiting you. So I have a lot of people that are in my DMs saying, Jordan, I'm in a fat loss phase. I'm 12 weeks in. I'm doing great. I feel great, but my coach is making me stop. It is you that I'm talking to here. You don't have to stop right now. You don't. You should take a break when taking a break feels like what you should do, when you are mentally exhausted and you need a break. Now, there's arguments for taking breaks before you need them, for just from, again, appeal to psychology. But if you're out there and you're doing great, two scenarios. One, the person who's out there doing great, feeling great, juice is still worth the squeeze, but somebody's telling them they have to take a break. Dude, you're killing that person's momentum. Chill. Let them keep going. There is no like, after this many weeks, your metabolism gets ruined. It's like, that's not how that works. Stop. The second is the person who, and this one always makes me laugh a little bit, the person who's like, I've been dieting for 12 weeks and I haven't lost any weight, but my coach is still making me take a break. On the one hand, physiologically, you have not been in a deficit for 12 weeks. You haven't been in a deficit at all over those 12 weeks. So physiologically, even if there was a physiological benefit, you don't need it because you haven't been in a deficit because you haven't lost any weight. The reason I think that that's still, it might be smart to take a break is because if you've been, you know, quote unquote dieting for 12 weeks and you haven't lost any weight yet, then clearly something's going on. You're not adhering, you know, you don't have the right plan. Things aren't going well. And I think taking a break from trying to adhere to the plan can help you just regroup, talk with your coach, come up with a new plan, find out where things were going wrong. So I don't mind the kind of mental step back in that scenario as well. And so people, you know, oh my God, Jordan, what do I do when I'm done with my deficit? Because when we talk about the deficit phase, we have to talk about getting back to maintenance. So when you're done, transition to your new expected maintenance with an understanding that one, it is an educated guess, right? What your new expected maintenance at your new body weight is a guess. It's an educated guess. You know, you might go into another calorie calculator and say, well, now I'm 140 pounds. I was 160 pounds. What's my new maintenance calories? Again, that is just an educated guess. And number two, that there is no metabolic advantage to doing this slowly. There's no metabolic advantage to doing this slowly. Reverse dieting, insofar as you are defining that as going slowly for the sake of a metabolic advantage so you can supercharge your metabolism or, you know, eat more without gaining weight, it is just not a thing. And I will link also in the description a podcast that I did with Eric Trexler on all of the science of reverse dieting. But let me get through the last expectation that you should have is that you will gain and probably should gain some weight. So transition to your new maintenance with an understanding that A, it's an educated guess. B, there's no metabolic advantage to doing this more slowly. And C, you will and probably should gain some weight back, whether that's lean mass, water, from glycogen, from food volume. You know, you're eating more food. You have more food in you at any given time. Now, my advice, very generally, is I'm closing my eyes. I'm imagining the person that has lost weight and they are proud of what they've lost and they are ready to be done, but they just don't want to gain the weight back. They're like, hey, I did a good job. I'm proud of myself. I don't want to gain the weight back. So I'm speaking to you now, where I understand that the benefit for that person in going slow is if they go slow, they're probably less likely to dramatically overshoot their calories. Because if you're like, oh, my new maintenance is 2,000, but it was really 1,700 and you jumped all the way to 2,000 because that's what the calorie calculator said, and then you spent, you know, months in a surplus not knowing what was going on, you might have caught on to that a little quicker if you went from, let's say you were finished your deficit at 1,400. If you went maybe right to 1,700 and then you stopped and then you waited to see how it would go and you kind of allowed the data and the biofeedback to guide the decisions from there. So what I like very generally, super duper generally, mega generally, is I like the halfway there and slow technique. Halfway there and then slow. What that means is if you finish your deficit at 1400 calories. And based on the data, based on your own data, you think that your maintenance calories at this new body weight is 1700. I'm making that up. 1800, 1900, 2000. Who cares? Let's say it's 1800. You finish your diet at 1400. You're still losing weight, but you're mentally exhausted and you want to be done with the diet. Well, what I like to do is jump halfway there. So I would go from 14 right to 16. I think that is enough of a jump for most people that they'll start to feel a little bit better. It's usually jumping halfway to where you expect you're going to end up gives you enough food that it feels nice. We can quell some of your I don't feel great feelings by jumping halfway there. We can also appeal to the side of you that doesn't want to gain weight, right? By jumping knowingly underneath probably where we're going to end up. And then what we can do is we can go up from there. Maybe it's 100 calories a week. Maybe it's, 100 calories every 2 weeks. I don't really like going up 200 calories I don't really like going up by 50 calories. That seems like mega micromanaging to me. Just like doesn't feel right. It's the precision is just unrealistic. So I usually go up about 100 calories a week or 100 calories every 2 weeks while we assess body weight, while we assess biofeedback. Biofeedback is kind of a buzzword. I just mean how you feel. If I have a client that gets to 1800 calories where we thought we would end up and she is still ravenous, like really ravenous, and body weight staying the same, we're going to keep eating. We're going to keep going. We're going to go up again because you need to marry the biofeedback with the data. So we need to make sure that you are, your maintenance calories means, where you're not gaining much weight. And I would expect to gain some weight. So, people are like, well, how much weight? It depends. Depends how much you lost. Depends how much you weigh now. Depends on your, a little bit on carbohydrate intake. But anywhere from like 1 to 5 pounds of water and glycogen and lean mass and maybe even some fat on the back end of a fat loss phase is pretty normal. But that's why having an intimate connection with your coach, talking, checking in, assessing the trend, talking about how you feel, how's your sleep, how's your training, how's your energy, libido, all that stuff can be really helpful to assess whether or not you've actually gotten yourself out of a deficit. So, wow, that was a really long podcast. Now, I admit that there are some parts of this like handling social events, like the diet breaks, like reverse dieting, like calories and protein versus macros, maybe these non-negotiables that could be their own, 15, 20 minute podcast. But I hope that this really helped you kind of hit those big buckets and maybe get a peek inside how my brain works on this. And there's not only one way to do this. These are my opinions. This is not me saying this is the exact blueprint, but I'd be interested. If you are interested in hearing more about one of these topics, you want me to dive a little bit deeper, shoot me a message. Say, hey, Jordan, I liked what you did, or I didn't like, or I didn't appreciate, or I didn't agree with you here. Like, I'd love to have those chats. Or, hey, I did this with a coach. What do you think? I really love interacting with you guys. It's been super fun. So, alrighty, I'll see you in the next episode. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.